This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this hour, local reaction to the verdict in the murder trial of former Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin for killing George Floyd.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count two, third-degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. Same caption, verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count three, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty.
Judge Peter Cahill there reading the verdicts from the jury. Reaction around the country and here in Boston was swift. From Floyd's family, his brother, Felonise Floyd, and his sister, LaTanya Floyd.
I feel relieved today that I finally have the opportunity for hopefully getting some sleep. A lot of days that I prayed and I hoped and I was speaking everything into existence. I said, I have faith that he will be convicted.
We got justice we want, okay? We want. He may not be here, but we want to see him handcuffed and walk out of that courthouse like my brother was handcuffed. I told him he has no more power. He's not in control anymore, but my brother is in control.
And right here in Boston, from Al Action in South Boston, Michael Terry in Roxbury, and public officials like Acting Mayor Kim Janey and former Governor Deval Patrick.
Tears of joy. When I heard the verdict, I cried.
Can you imagine somebody doing that to you? You're begging for your life? The police? I'm just glad it was done. It's not going to bring him back, but you can't just go around murdering people, and you're supposed to protect and serve.
While many of us breathe a sigh of relief, George Floyd and countless others are still dead. And the conditions that led to so many senseless killings still exist.
We still have important legislation stuck in the United States Senate. We have reforms that have been proposed in state legislatures, in city councils, in police departments that have not moved to final resolution.
So where do we go from here? In Boston, in Massachusetts, what does accountability look like? What does justice look like? A little later in the show, we'll add your voices to the mix at 1-800-423-8255. But first, we want to talk to another important local leader, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. DA Rollins, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Let me just ask your reaction to the tape we just heard in the verdicts from yesterday, DA Rollins.
Incredibly moving and powerful. My reaction was exactly the same. I stood in my living room and cried. We're just exhausted, and we aren't even family members of George Floyd. We aren't family members of Breonna Taylor. We aren't family members of Ahmaud Arbery, but we are all experiencing vicarious trauma because in some of those circumstances, we all witnessed their executions.
What have you heard from co-workers, constituents, colleagues today?
Absolutely relief. I got many texts from many of my friends of various races, just saying, thank God, you know, amen. But to be honest, it is just such a sad state of affairs that we were fearful that this might not be the result. There is, in the Black community in particular, an expectation that we are not going to be successful, where certain communities get the privilege and benefit of assuming things will always work out for them.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about the fact you come to this discussion as a law enforcement officer, as an advocate for reform, as a woman of color here in Boston. We know there will be a lot of social action tonight, tomorrow, the next couple of days. You've asked police to have understanding for those who are hurting right now. And you talk about the pain of not having the expectation that justice will happen. What do you want to see from law enforcement in these next 24 to 48 hours to demonstrate that understanding?
I believe that, you know, I was very deliberate in making sure that I didn't just ask the protesters to not engage in behavior, right? That is also insulting. There's nothing, you know, could you imagine after watching a murder to be told, please keep your voice down and don't destroy any property, which of course it appears you care more about property than my life, right? So there's a piece of this where we, with compassion and understanding, said you should absolutely be utilizing or engaging your First Amendment rights. But we also specifically asked the police to have empathy and compassion and understand the hurt that people are feeling right now.
So I want to ask you the legal dimension of this. Are there ways that this legal finding affects your work here in the Commonwealth? What does it mean? And maybe the answer is it doesn't, but does it mean anything for you as a DA here in the Commonwealth?
Of course it does. I mean, I think in the world we live in now, there are no longer jurisdictional lines, right? Unfortunately, there are people that watched George Floyd's execution and felt as if that were the Boston police, right? We have to do a better job at law enforcement explaining, you know, that is not us. But we also must then require law enforcement to be vocal and stand up and say, he does not represent us. Yesterday, I had the privilege of standing with the mayor and addressing the city, and I made sure to say the thing. You know, I'm grateful for the prosecution and the jury, but I am deeply grateful for all of the police officers that stood up in this trial and said, absolutely not. This man does not, we are a noble profession. This man does not represent us at all. And what he did was egregiously wrong.
You know, we're exploring today on the show this idea of accountability versus justice. I'm guessing you're aware that Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison pointed out that the verdict isn't justice. He talked about accountability, and then he said that accountability is a first step toward justice. Does that resonate for you and your work and the reforms that you've been pursuing?
Absolutely. And let's please point out that the Attorney General had to swoop in because the elected district attorneys were not handling the case appropriately, which is precisely what we saw in Ahmaud Arbery. There were three district attorneys that watched that same execution by the McMichael father and son and said, nope, nothing to see here. Georgia has a citizen's arrest statute. We don't think a crime was committed. And thank God the Georgia Bureau of Investigations swooped in and within 24 to 48 hours charged both of those men with murder. So, you know, accountability is a first step. But we want to live in a world where George Floyd doesn't have to be executed for us to believe or for us, you know, for people to look at us and say, wait a minute, maybe all the things you've been talking about for a long time about, you know, two different criminal legal systems or disparate treatment in virtually everything that has now been exposed through COVID-19. It's just really frustrating that it takes our murder in order for people to pay attention when other communities and people have the privilege of simply expressing, you know, hey, I don't like that. And then it stops, right? What is it about us as Black people that we have to be murdered in order for you to hear us?
You just expressed some frustration about the lack of action among DAs. But before we let you go, I want to talk to you about a case that you are prosecuting, which is former Boston police officer Patrick Rose. Yesterday, there was a release of internal investigation files in the case. He's now accused of sexually abusing six children. These were files from an investigation from a previous accusation in 95. Do you have reaction you can share with us to the contents of those files? They were redacted, but the files that were released by the city yesterday.
Yeah, we will be releasing a statement about that. But, you know, what I just want people to remember is there's a tension between the obvious right of the public to know about a public official. This individual was elected by his peers to be the highest ranking member of the largest police union in the Boston Police Department. So he was the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. And I am a member of law enforcement, in fact, the chief law enforcement officer. I can tell you, police departments gossip more than middle schools. So I know all of those people knew about the allegations against this man, whether sustained, and they were, or not, and they still elected him to lead them. We now know that after he was allowed to go back to his job at during that that time period, he was harming other people. So there is a public right to know, but there is also a real right for victims to have privacy and for their story to be theirs to tell. So I will never defend, please don't talk about Patrick Rose Sr. Look, he chose to engage in this behavior. We are very confident that we will find him responsible, and so will a jury. But we need to be really careful to make sure that these individuals who, he stole things from them. He stole their very essence by taking something he had no right to from children. And so I want us to honor their privacy, but I also want to work as hard as I can to make sure that never happens again, that we have systems in place where people don't get to continue working or being around children when these type of allegations happen. I know we need due process, but we now know that the system failed these children.
That is Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. DA Rollins, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
So listening into that conversation was WBUR senior reporter Allie Jarmanning, who's been following the Patrick Rose case here in Boston and the just-released internal investigation file on Rose. Allie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the Rose materials, I just want to take a second to get your reaction to what you just heard from DA Rollins.
Yeah, I was really struck by her asking police to have understanding and her empathy with the people that were protesting, what she said about the insult of being told to keep your voice down and not destroy property, like property is more valuable than a life. You don't hear that from a law enforcement officer a lot. And, she called on police officers, locally to step up and say, this does not represent us. Yesterday, she thanked the police officers who testified against Chauvin specifically. And on Patrick Rose, she noted rightfully that he was chosen by his peers to lead a huge, powerful union, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, and that the officers who voted for him, some of them at least, had to know what he was accused of. And her noting the tension between protecting the identity and stories of the victims of Patrick Rose, but also the very obvious right to know when a public official is accused of something like this.
So let's dive further there, and I'm just going to quickly recap for our listeners. Patrick Rose is accused of child sexual abuse in 6 cases. The Globe broke a story about a prior abuse allegation against Rose in 1995 that showed that he wasn't charged, but the department determined he'd likely committed a crime at that time. And as you say, he went on to serve as the head of the union in another 20 years. Last week, Acting Mayor Kim Janey vowed a speedy release of the investigation files. And yesterday, just as the verdict in the Chauvin murder trial was coming out, they did so. So what do we know from the documents they released?
So only 13 pages of the 100-page file was released. So we have a very limited window into this internal investigation. But what we can see is that Rose was put on desk duty after he was criminally charged with sexual assault of a child in 1995. And that meant he was not working on the streets and he did not have his gun. And he remained on desk duty even after the criminal charges against him were dropped, because the victim wouldn't testify. And after the internal police investigation, as you mentioned, found in 1996 that it was likely he committed a crime. And so that was until the union complained. They sent a letter in 1997 to then Police Commissioner Paul Evans threatening a grievance. And Rose was quietly put back on duty and nobody ever said a thing publicly and nobody moved to fire him. And as we know, he went on to work for the police department for 20 more years and led the union. And he retired in 2018 and was charged with sexual assault of more children last summer.
Is it worth noting the timing of the release yesterday, Allie?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say whether if it's just coincidence or what, but we got the release from the city with the records at 3:41 p.m. And that's just 10 minutes after we got word that a verdict was coming from Minneapolis and the Chauvin trial. It just was really odd and hectic timing.
And tell us a little bit more about why so few pages were released.
Yeah, so under Mayor Walsh, the city refused to give the documents entirely. They said there wasn't one page that they could provide. They were citing a state law designed to protect the identities of sexual assault survivors. They said that prohibited them from releasing anything. Acting Mayor Janey reversed course somewhat by ordering the law department to release what they could from the records, and that's how we got those 13 pages.
And I understand that former Commissioner Paul Evans has responded. He is implicated, if that's the right word, in the documents. What has he said?
Yeah, so he and the then superintendent in charge of internal affairs in the 90s, they released a joint statement last night. And they said basically they believe then and still believe now that everything possible was done to hold Rose accountable. They say that because the 12-year-old victim in the case didn't want to move forward, allegedly because Rose pressured him to recant, they couldn't do anything more. And they criticized the Janey administration for their characterization of what happened. And they also criticized Janey for only releasing about a tenth of the whole file. They are saying that the entire file should be released.
So put the release of what we do have and the events that led to it into context for us, Allie. You've been reporting on policing for quite a while now.
Yeah, so this is a big deal. You know, I mean, a police officer was allowed to work for 2 decades after his own police department found he likely sexually abused a child. But it's an even bigger deal because of the moment we're in with the demands for police accountability and reform. And these records seem to illustrate what the blue wall of silence looks like in practice. And now we have a new mayor who doesn't seem as beholden to the police department's pattern of secrecy. And we have a brand new city agency, the Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. Its first order of business is going to be investigating how Rose was able to stay on the job for so long. So what comes out of all this is going to speak to how solid the promises for police reform really are in Boston.
And you have some wisdom about what it takes to get these kinds of documents. How remarkable is it that they're out there?
Yeah, it's a huge struggle to get any records from the Boston Police Department, let alone records like these. And I think it's a good sign for transparency and accountability that Mayor Janey ordered some of these records released. But the city is still withholding other important records, like those of Police Commissioner Dennis White. He's on leave while the city investigates old domestic violence allegations against him, but the city has refused to provide any internal affairs records about him. And they haven't even responded to our requests about a request for internal affairs records of interim police leader Gregory Long. So I really hope that the release of the Rose records signals more transparency under the Janey administration and that maybe the department just won't be such a black box in the future.
All right, that is WBUR senior reporter Allie Jarmanning. Allie, thank you.
Thank you.
Reflecting on the conviction of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, what it means for police reform nationally and especially here at home. Before the break, we spoke with Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, both as a prosecutor and as an advocate for reform of our criminal justice system. There's more we want to comb out now about the legal implications of this verdict, especially legal implications here at home. To do that, we turn to Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe, an inaugural columnist for the Emancipator, and a WBUR contributor. Kimberly is also a lawyer. Kimberly, welcome back.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And also joining us, Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be on again.
Listeners, we do open this up to you. If you have legal questions about the ramifications, the trial, our guests will do what they can to answer your questions. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And then later in the show, we'll open it up wider to your general reflections on the verdict. So, Judge Gertner, I'm going to start with you. It feels like we've seen so many instances of people dying at the hands of police over the last few years. I mean, we heard DA Rollins with a list of names at the beginning. And in so many of those cases, officers were never even charged, never mind convicted. What made this case so different?
I think there are a number of factors in this case. I think one was whereas all the other cases are cases where a police officer at least argued that this was a spur-of-the-moment decision, right? A spur-of-the-moment, he believed that he was in danger, a spur-of-the-moment, even the accidental shooting arguably is a spur-of-the-moment kind of thing. This is hardly a spur-of-the-moment thing. With Chauvin, you're the 9-plus minutes where he had his knee on Floyd's neck makes it look like something very, very different. There was no deference that you might give to a cop for making decisions in an instant. This was more sustained. The other thing that was remarkable is the numbers of police officers who testified against him. So that the debate about what a reasonable officer would do, which is what the debate was, you had these numbers of police officers saying, this is not reasonable, this is beyond the pale. And then there was, I like to describe this as the Rodney King defense, which is the Rodney King, if he was a black man who was beaten in full view of a video of cameras, long time ago, and the officers who did that got off, and the reason they got off was that they argued, you can't trust the video. Let me tell you what was going on before, and in describing what was going on before, they were using every racist trope they could. This time, that was not possible because it was not just the video. It was also multiple witnesses who were there. So they couldn't sort of recharacterize what had gone on. And I think that made this unique. I would have been astonished and let alone horrified had he been acquitted of any of these charges.
Kimberly, let me just let you either build on or react to what you just heard from Judge Gertner.
Yeah, I agree with what Judge Gertner is saying. I will just add a couple things. I mean, when you look at Rodney King from the 90s, I think there are other things that have changed too, including the Black Lives Matter movement that we've seen over the last year really gain traction, gain support, and really capture the nation in a way that it hadn't in the past. When Rodney King's when the trial about Rodney King's beating took place, there was still a very strong support for police, a presumption that you believe police and that you support police and that any defense that police give would work. If you look at the Derek Chauvin trial, the defense was very similar in terms of saying things like, in this case, George Floyd was on drugs. He may have posed an even greater threat. He could have gotten superhuman strength. These are all things that were argued about Rodney King successfully, but they failed here in part, as Judge Gertner said, because you had police that were testifying against Chauvin. But the reason they were is because of that shift in public attitudes about policing, this realization that the continual killing of Black people in America is unacceptable and something needs to be done about it. And the only difference I have with Judge Gertner is that I very much braced for there to be acquittals or hung juries or something else. I was not as sure that there would be any convictions here, just because if past is prologue, we have seen videos in the cases such as the killing of Eric Garner and others that did not end in conviction, sometimes didn't even end in charges. So it was a happy ending, but it was not one I was expecting.
So let's bring this home now. I'll go back to you, Judge Gertner. Talk about potential legal implications from this case for us here in the Commonwealth.
It's hard to know because it's hard to know whether this is sui generis for the reasons that Kimberly talked about, whether this is unique for the reasons she talked about. And it certainly should catch up police officers short that there is a high profile and clear conviction of very, very serious charges, that there are limits to where excessive force can go before it becomes murder. And I think that is significant. The question is, in the ordinary case, as I said, where there is a spur-of-the-moment decision, the police officer says he is in danger. The police officer says that he has to, intervene in order to prevent someone else from being in danger. It's the spur-of-the-moment stuff reflects the quite extraordinary culture of policing. It's the spur-of-the-moment stuff that reflects training.
So we lost Judge Gertner's sound there for a second, and I'm sure we'll get her back. Kimberly Atkins, I'm going to turn to the phones for just a minute, and listeners, if you do have questions about the legal dimensions of this case, the trial, the verdict, The number is 800-423-8255. We've got Rama on the line from Magnolia, Massachusetts. Rama, go ahead.
Wondering why, I don't watch TV, so maybe they have been on, but why are we not hearing from more police officers directly right now with the timing of everything going on? Current police officers, or maybe those willing to talk out a little bit more, maybe some retired ones who can speak to the current rank and file and maybe talk some sense into them about this whole blue code of silence. And what is it going to take for these guys and gals to break that down, but still be respectful to their colleagues, but still, you know, be protect and serve? How is that going to look going forward? Is that really going to change?
Thanks for that call, Rama. And to that point, we had actually pulled a tweet from Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies, who is the president of the Massachusetts Major City Chiefs of Police Association. This was yesterday. The tweets said, the jury in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin reached its verdict a short time ago, finding him guilty of all three charges. As members of the Mass Major City Police Chiefs Association, we strongly believe that not only was the defendant afforded due process as is required by our Constitution and in conformance with our system of justice, but that the honorable and informed jury absolutely got it right and that justice was served. We hope that the family of George Floyd finds some solace in this historic verdict. There's an excerpt there. Kimberly, that there is, I mean, Judge Gertner touched on it, this question of whether this will have an impact on internal police department behaviors. You heard DA mm-hmm. Rollins perhaps talk about that before the break too. Legal thoughts there?
Yeah, I think we have seen some changes already happening. I mean, I think in some police departments, they are bringing in folks to work on the culture of policing, which is a crucial part of this. I mean, you can't get at making any reforms here until you break down the basic culture in which police, for example, see black and brown folks as more of a threat. And therefore, this standard that Judge Gertner talked about, the reasonable police officer and whether the level of fear or the level of threat that they perceived, if racism is baked into that, the whole system is even further broken. So you're bringing some police departments are bringing folks in to try to address that. On the other hand, you have police unions, which are incredibly powerful, incredibly strong, and are pushing back tooth and nail against efforts to reform police. And so long as that culture is maintained, you see that tension between those two. I think until really police unions realize that their job is to protect the pensions and the health care and benefits and wages of police officers and not try to shield them from any accountability when there is wrongdoing, I think it's going to be very difficult to change that police dynamic.
I know we have Judge Gertner again. Judge Gertner, I want to also ask about the appeal dimension here. Judge Peter Cahill referenced statements towards the end of the proceedings made by Representative Maxine Waters while she attended protests over the weekend, suggesting that that might create the possibility of an appeal. President Biden also talked about how he was praying for, quote, the right verdict, end quote, before a verdict had been delivered. Do those things create grounds for an appeal?
I think that the defense would certainly argue that, but it's interesting. I wondered if it was a symbolic moment for the judge. He announced that he was displeased with that it could provide a basis for appeal, but he didn't take the next step. And the next step might have been, for example, to poll the jury. You have to be careful about how you do that. But presumably at the beginning of every day, he said to people, if you have read, seen, or heard anything about this case, then you should come forward. This happened while they were mid-trial, so presumably they didn't have access to TVs. So I wondered if he said that because he was, is expressing his displeasure that something could try to upend the trial, but that he really didn't take it seriously because he didn't do anything to suggest that he was going to find out and we actually heard it. I also have to admit that in the universe of comments, certainly Representative Waters' comments seemed, hardly substantial here. Saying we have to be more confrontational is not saying let's burn down buildings if the verdict goes in the wrong direction. I think that he was being annoyed, but not necessarily that this is a real ground for appeal. If anything, when I stand back and look at the rulings in the case, I thought that his rulings were enormously pro-defense. And, it, you know, for example, like allowing in evidence of George Floyd's earlier arrest and his reaction to being arrested, that was a discretionary decision. He could well have gone in the other direction. But having done that, that was a very pro-defense ruling because it really caricatured the victim in this case.
So, Kimberly, and I know you're going to stay with us after the break as we widen this conversation from the legal dimension, but briefly, this idea that this is a moment of accountability but not yet a moment of justice. What is the next step towards justice in the courts? Is it the sentencing?
In this case, yes. It is a sentence that will take place in 2 months. Derek Chauvin can get up to 40 years in prison. I think something shorter than that will be seen as an injustice. And certainly any attempts at an appeal, I agree with Judge Gertner, there was no reversible error there, ensuring that conviction sticks. But I think it's important to underscore, even legally, when you're talking about laws that can be changed, as well as rules within policing, this verdict is a small, small part of what justice looks like. It in itself is not bringing the closure to the greater American public that they are seeking.
And Judge Gertner, last question to you. What are you looking for, expecting, thinking about from sentencing?
I don't think there's any chance that Chauvin will get anything near the maximum sentence, which is 40 years. Minnesota is a sentencing guideline state. There are enforceable sentencing guidelines. The range for the things of which he was convicted are maybe 10 and a half to 15 years. The judge can go over that. If the judge makes findings that, for example, George Floyd was particularly vulnerable, that the crime was done with particular cruelty, or that it was done in the presence of children, and he could go over that. But I think that we're all disturbed when the press reports over and over again, you know, he could get up to 40 years. It's doubtful that he would get 40 years. Given guidelines for manslaughter and even the murder offenses here that are much less than that. He's a first offender. The judge would have to really make some very substantial findings here to go very much above that.
All right. And that is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, WBUR's legal analyst. Thank you, Judge Gertner. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This hour, we are talking about policing and police reform, accountability versus justice, all in the wake of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin's conviction for the murder of George Floyd. For the rest of the hour, we invite you to continue to join us, and we want to just ask you how you reacted to the verdict. Do you see this as a step toward justice? What do you think it means for our cities and towns here, for you as a community member, a neighbor, a resident of our cities and towns? And what do you want or need to see next? Join us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Still with us on the line is Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe and inaugural columnist for The Emancipator, a new publication in Boston's abolitionist tradition created by the Globe and Boston University's Center for Anti-Racist Research. Kimberly is also a WBUR contributor. Kimberly, thanks for sticking with us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
And we're also welcoming now Imari Paris Jeffries, Executive Director of King Boston. Imari, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be with you both today.
So we try to bring every story home to Greater Boston. And one way that we do that with our listeners is to bring it home to ourselves. Imari, how did the verdict hit home for you yesterday?
Yeah, you know, Tiziana, you know, it was both a sense of relief, but, relief doesn't always mean a good thing. It just means an ease of pressure, right? And so I think, you know, we were experiencing, watching the trial, experiencing substance use disorder on trial, young teen trauma on trial, poverty on trial. You know, some might say 2020 was on trial in the backdrop of two other police shootings and a video capturing police abusing a member of the armed forces. You know, this is in the backdrop. And so while there was a relief that accountability occurred, I can't say that justice was fully executed on, justice was fully done, you know, because, you know, it's like taking a shower in a mud pit. We're getting clean on top, but you know, we know that half of our body is still involved in the muck.
Kimberly, let me just give you a chance to react to what Amari just said.
No, I think I agree so much with it. I mean, I think so many people yesterday and today in particular, a day after, I think so many of us expected to feel better. You know, I mean, the last year in large part was defined by two crises, the pandemic and policing in America for many of us. And that video of George Floyd being killed was a traumatic event that really shook the ground under our feet. And we thought that justice in that case would bring some sort of sense of satisfaction. And it really didn't, because of the amount that still needs to be done. I still fear interactions with police. I still believe that police unions have too much power. I still believe that qualified immunity, the way that it is used, is wrong. It just seems like a drop in the bucket to what needs to be done.
Let's go to the phones here, 800-423-8255, to reflect with us today on how you're reacting to the verdict, what you want next for your community. We've got Kim on the line in Brookline. Kim, go ahead.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I just want to preface it by saying that I think that what happened to George Floyd and other African-Americans by the police, some police, I should say, is horrendous, and I'm so happy that Chauvin was found guilty on all counts. But I feel like the media needs to take a more balanced reporting to highlight good policing. The police are feeling maligned, and frankly, I think they're feeling very vulnerable. And I think, you know, maybe if you had brought some police onto this show to say how it's impacting them, how do they feel about what is happening, you'll see that good policemen, which are the majority, really did not like what happened. They don't like what's happening, and they do want to change it, but their voices are not coming through. And I feel like the media needs to take responsibility for moving that forward for all of us, and especially for those good cops.
Okay. Thanks for that pushback, Kim. And if you are an officer and listening today, and you want to tell us how you're feeling in the moment, you can join us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Imari, one of the things that we heard from Judge Gertner and from DA Rollins at the beginning of the show was reflection on how many officers participated in the trial and called out Chauvin's behavior. We have Kim saying it is incumbent upon us to reflect on the good officers walking the beat every day. I just want to give you a chance to react to Kim's pushback there and the narrative that we are having.
I think public safety is the battleground where we're having the anti-racist conversation. It just so happens that public safety is the space. You know, I'm watching, if you watch TV and we're watching Disney Plus and whatever, you know, I'm watching the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where the Falcon, who's a Black man, is interrogating what it means for a Black man to be Captain America, right?
Yeah.
And so when I think about this moment in time, I'm thinking about Christus Attucks. And so when the soldiers who were set to the stage to police could not handle the situation, they killed Christus Attucks. And in the trial of Christus Attucks, the soldier said that he was a man of physical robustness, and his musculature was the excuse to kill him, to shoot him. And so therefore he was killed. And so there's a history of Black folks being the martyrs. And so the martyr of the Boston Massacre is a Black man, and it set off the American Revolutionary War, which we look upon with favor. And so here we are, hundreds of years later, George Floyd is the Christus Attucks of this moment. And so he's the great martyr. His physical robustness was used as an excuse to apply a force that was unnecessary. And so now we're having a conversation where we're interrogating racism, right? And so there's this history of our country engaging Black bodies for revolutionary purposes, where Black bodies are at the crossroads of interrogating what it means to be American. And so, you know, are we having a conversation around what does the role of the police force has in perpetuating white supremacy? We are having that conversation. But this is just the venue in which white supremacy is playing itself out. There are a myriad of ways in which we could have this conversation where Black bodies are being choked out. We could have this over education. We could have this over medicine. We could have this over sports. I mean, you name the subject, we could also have this conversation. There's a Crispus Attucks amongst many other venues in which we could have this conversation.
And Tiziana, can I say something too? Since Kim was directing her comments at members of the media, and that is me, I think we do a disservice when we actually frame this conversation in terms of good cops versus bad cops. What we are talking about, and I think what Amari was getting to in his way of going through history, is that we are talking about a broken system in which all cops are operating. Right. So we are seeing the results of that broken system, which is founded on racism, which draws folks from white supremacy, just as white supremacists are drawn to the military, which has so many inherent biases in the way that policing is done that criminalizes Black folks from jump. That makes it impossible for a good cop, quote unquote, good cop, to operate within that system. It makes policing more dangerous for quote unquote good cops. It makes policing more dangerous for everyone. So it is incumbent. It is those good cops that should be speaking up the loudest against this system and calling the loudest for reforms to the system. It was heartening to see members of the police force testifying in this case for the prosecution. That's a great start. But this isn't an idea that we're just focusing on a few bad apples. This is an idea that we are focusing on a broken system that puts everyone in danger.
Amari, I was going to go to the phones, but I want to come back to you on a dimension of what Kimberly just said, and then we'll pick up a call. You know, this solidarity idea that a broken system hurts everyone. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, you know, and I think, you know, in this moment in time where we are interrogating racism, we must interrogate policies and structures, right? But we also have to interrogate systems of socialization. And so I think what Kimberly was also talking about is the system of socialization that law enforcement or policing both requires you to accept. It requires you to strip down parts of who you are in order to participate to its full extent. And so that's part of the broken system. And so it's a multi-pronged approach in both, you know, how we address policing. Policing is just one of the spaces, this self-regulating systems, right? And so how do we interrogate self-regulating systems like the police department or even higher education, these systems where the few in power make the decisions of who gets to be in the club, how those people in the club are promoted, and how those people in the club are penalized or punished. And so self-regulating systems in the 21st century have to be interrogated so for us to really engage in what it means for us to be anti-racist, inclusive, and welcoming to a myriad of different people and folks.
I'd like to grab one more call here, and I'll probably turn to you after word, Kimberly, because I think this call is about how we begin to do systems reform. We've got Keiko on the line in Swampscott. Keiko, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and I just really appreciate this conversation and all the ways it's being explored. I really resonated with Amari's comments earlier. We were talking about a shower and a mud bath, right? And so I feel like, you know, the Derek Chauvin trial gave us prosecutorial precedent, right? Like, okay, we can bring police officers to trial to charge them for crime. You know, then the sentencing happens at the judge, you know, at the judge's level, as Judge Gertner was talking about, you know, Minnesota's sentencing standards. And so I'm just wondering, you know, as the everyday layperson, where is the opportunity for reform here? Is it at the sentencing level? You know, is that something that happens with individual judges? Does it happen legislatively? And kind of how does the average everyday person contribute towards that systemic reform?
Thanks for the call, Keiko. Kimberly, let me turn to you.
Yeah, the clearest way that the average everyday person can engage and work on reform is to vote. All of these decisions are made by elected officials at the local, county, state, and federal level. When it comes to things like sentencing, I mean, in the last segment, I take Judge Gertner's point that it's unlikely that that Derek Chauvin will get the full 40 years that the law provides that he should be able to get because of sentencing requirements and other things. So that is why it's important that you vote for your legislatures and you let them know that you want laws that are tough and that come with severe penalties when something like this happens. When it comes to how your police are dealt with, how the hiring decisions that Amari was talking about, that is handled by city councils and mayors. So you vote for them and you make it clear that you want to hold them accountable for those decisions. Really, voting is crucially important, and letting your public officials know, even if it's not an election year, how you feel is crucially important in order to bring about these changes that you see happening in front of you.
Imari, we've got maybe a minute left, and in listening to Kimberly, I'm also thinking of the fact that we have devil to work out in the details of police reform that was passed at the state level and reforms that are beginning to go underway at the city level. What does this verdict do to the public will to put teeth in those reforms?
You know, I think it gives us a little bit more sail in our winds. And again, it's accountability, not justice. You know, there's, you know, a lot more for us to do. One third of pretextual stops involving police and Black folks end up in a Black person getting shot, right? And so that comes from somewhere. People are being, and officers are being socialized into seeing Black folks as more adult, bigger, stronger, not human, subhuman. And so that type of racist socialization also needs to be addressed. Folks who have been socialized into this mindset join the police force, won't join the military, and then they get to live out the sense of belief, this belief system. And so, you know, when we're talking about what regular people can do, I think we have to interrogate our belief systems in the ways that we've been taught how Black people and brown people and Asians and Indigenous folks walk in this world. And so that's where it starts. And so it's the police and law enforcement is just a venue for racism and white supremacy to manifest itself. It's not the root of the problem. And so we have a lot to do to interrogate all the recharging stations of white supremacy that exist in our society.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Imari Paris-Jeffries, Executive Director of King Boston, and Kimberly Atkins, Senior Opinion Writer for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Imari, Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Listeners, there was a lot there. These are conversations we will continue, and we will continue to engage in them with you. Thank you for listening today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Tune in again tomorrow for more.